From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, veteran comic George Carlin talks with us without using any of those seven dirty words you can't say on the radio. Also today, John Mahoney tells us why at the age of 37, he gave up a steady job and took up acting. He's since been in the movies Eight Men Out, Moonstruck, Betrayed, and Say Anything. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews four new sitcoms. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Officials from many less developed nations expressed skepticism today at an offer of free oil from Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. An Iraqi spokesman made the offer today, saying that third world countries could have the oil free of charge, regardless of their stand on Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Iraq maintained that the gift oil wouldn't violate international sanctions because it wouldn't involve buying or selling. Third world delegates at a United Nations conference in Paris said they regarded the offer as a propaganda ploy that would be impossible to make good on. The foreign ministers of Iran and Iraq have completed talks in Tehran to reestablish peace between the two nations, which could lead to problems for the international blockade. Terry Phillips reports from Baghdad.
Iraq's foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, and his Iranian counterpart, Ali Akbar Velayati, discussed ways to expedite the exchange of all prisoners of war taken during the eight-year conflict. They have also laid the groundwork to renew diplomatic relations, according to the official Iraqi news agency. If true, that could water down the economic embargo imposed on Iraq. There are already reports of some trade leaks in the Iran-Iraq border. But if these two former enemies create a political alliance, it could effectively negate UN-authorized sanctions. Iraq has been rationing such consumer goods as bread, sugar, and cooking oil. Many restaurants are already closing due to limited supplies. For National Public Radio, I'm Terry Phillips in Baghdad.
Reports from Kuwait say the situation is getting worse. Supplies of fresh food are running out, and many of the essential services are no longer functioning properly. The BBC's Jack Thompson reports.
Electricity supplies are patchy and the sewerage system has virtually stopped working. That raises the possibility of a cholera outbreak. Indeed, disease and hunger seem to be the biggest dangers facing the large numbers of people from third world countries still stranded in Kuwait. A Norwegian diplomat arriving in Baghdad said conditions for more than 500,000 Indians, Pakistanis, Sri Lankans, Bangladeshis and Filipinos were appalling. They simply couldn't afford the food prices being charged on the black market. British officials say Kuwaiti resistance against the Iraqi army seems to be increasing. Gunfire is heard day and night in Kuwait, and clearly Iraqi troops are having problems dealing with sniper attacks and ambushes.
The BBC's Jack Thompson reporting. A rally on Wall Street collapsed today at the close of trading. Prices were up for much of the day as oil prices fell and tensions appeared to ease in the Persian Gulf. When it was all over, though, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 4 points to close at 2,615.59. Advances edged declines in light trading. Volume was 120 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George Carlin is the comic who said the seven dirty words you can't say on TV. He didn't say them on TV, but when he used them in a 1972 performance, he was arrested. And when radio station WBAI played his recording of the monologue, it led to a major FCC decision which upheld restrictions on indecent language on the radio. George Carlin was one of the most popular countercultural comics of the early 70s. He's since become a popular guest on The Tonight Show, recorded many albums, and branched out into movies. I spoke to him in June before the premiere of an HBO special. Carlin says that while some people object to the language he uses, what he objects to is the sanitized euphemisms that have entered our language, euphemisms that only obscure meaning.
Some of these are small examples that, taken as a larger body, make the point a little bit better, because these are trivial things. But there is an example of something that happened in this century to a certain condition, a combat condition, when people can't handle any more combat. In the First World War, back over 70 years ago, that was called shell shock, which is very descriptive, very simple, honest, and direct language. Shell shock. It describes exactly what it is. It almost sounds like guns. In the Second World War, a generation later, they decided to call that battle fatigue. It's twice as long now, four syllables, takes longer to say, doesn't seem to hurt. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock, battle fatigue. Then we had Korea, 1950, they called the same thing operational exhaustion. Now the humanity is completely missing from it, and it sounds like something that might happen to your Jeep. And in Vietnam, of course, thanks to the deception surrounding that war, the same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. And my point is, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, maybe Vietnam veterans might have gotten some attention at the time, because the language would have described what was wrong with them instead of describing some psychologist's ideal phrase for taking up space.
One of the things you're very famous for is the seven dirty words case. And
right.
This is you had a routine about seven dirty words you can't say on television.
Right.
In 1972, you were arrested for doing this on stage.
Yeah.
And in just a few years later, a radio station in New York, a listener-supported station,
right,
played the routine from the record, and that became a kind of classic obscenity case.
It went to the Supreme Court, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very important case that everybody
footnote.
In radio knows about.
I'm a legal footnote.
And, of course, you lost.
I wasn't really an active participant.
Right, I don't mean you personally,
but the
radio station
they
lost.
They did indeed. Yeah. The FCC was upheld.
Now, part of what this routine was about was the absurdity of banning words,
yes,
the absurdity of being,
yeah,
so offended
one
by language.
One would think that would be protected speech.
And an example you gave was, and I can't give the full thing, but you said you can say, don't prick your finger, but if you reverse the order of those words, that would be considered obscene.
Right.
Did the judges in the various trials get the point, do you think?
Absolutely not. I don't think they even listened. I'm sure they didn't listen to the record to hear it in its fullest and best context. I'm sure they read portions of the transcript. It's in the interest, I guess, of the white male religious corporate paramilitary state that we live in to control us. And the FCC, of course, has control only over broadcast media. And I guess they found a way to interpret that form of expression differently from the printed word and the spoken word. The argument, which I think is specious, is that because this goes out into the home, that somehow it's going to injure someone morally if it comes through the speaker. They don't take into account the fact that there is an on-off switch on every radio and there is a station selector knob for changing the station. The man who made the complaint, one of these moral commandos, a professional moralist who wants us to live his way, sat in his car with his son and listened to the entire broadcast, and I assume they were not morally degraded in any way. I assume the child has developed in a normal way in spite of listening to that routine. So where is the argument? I don't follow the damage. I don't see where the damage occurs in this language being used.
You know, Lenny Bruce always said that when he was up on obscenity charges,
yeah,
that he wished he could perform the material for the judges, you,
yeah,
know, because they were hearing, you know, either reading transcriptions or they were hearing people quote the material.
A cop was doing his act.
Right, that's it. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And, you know, Bruce really felt, well, if they're going to get what it's about, they have to hear me do it. Did you,
sure,
feel that way yourself?
Well, I feel that the thing was rigged to start with, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think the outcome was inevitable. But surely it would have been fairer to the process to listen to the recording. And the other thing about it is there was a warning given, there was a disclaimer given by the radio station saying that there'll be language on this next recording which you may find offensive. There was the point made that it was in the context of speaking about protected speech. And certainly there, in that case, that has to be a redeeming artistic feature, which is one of the tests for obscenity. Of course, they didn't test it for obscenity. They called it indecency and got around the obscenity law in that manner.
Now, you were arrested in Milwaukee in 1972.
Yeah, now that was more for public, what you call it, disorderly conduct. Concert was outdoors, and the speakers... The concert setting outdoors was in a larger setting of a festival, a summer fest.
Mm-hmm.
And so the complaint was made on the basis of the fact that the language coming from these speakers flowed out of the concert area into the area of the general public. And the policeman felt that was wrong. I think his idea was, he said, there were mothers listening to this, which I don't understand at all. But at any rate, we just waited, as the lawyer told me, he said, we're going to wait a few months on this case until a judge comes around who understands the First Amendment. And apparently in Milwaukee, that took about 6 months.
Did you expect to be arrested? Did you have any idea this was coming?
Oh, absolutely not. No, and I think it was a spur-of-the-moment decision on the part of one policeman.
And how did they come get you?
Oh, they just came backstage. My wife came out on stage during the show to warn me that they were back there. She came out ostensibly to bring me a glass of water, and it was a large kind of unruly audience and everything, so an interruption like that wasn't particularly damaging to the flow of the show or anything. So she just got me aside and said, there's police backstage and they're going to arrest you. So I went off stage a different way where they weren't waiting, and at that time I was still a user of illegal substances, and so I got rid of what I had on me so that the only arrest would be for this spoken violation and not for something else, which they would have loved to catch me doing.
George Carlin is my guest. How did you start using, quote, dirty words in your performances?
Well, I always felt that I didn't want to be denied a significant portion of the language, significant not numerically, but in terms of... impact in speech. You know, I just felt that if I was forever going to avoid these words, that I was somewhat crippling my ability to express myself. I use those words in my private life. People I know do. They're valuable words for expression. They give spice and emphasis to language, and they in the sense of comedy monologues. They can be very useful in giving characters, enhancing characterizations, and giving emphasis to ideas. So I didn't want to be crippled by not having them available to me. See, like, my point is, a person like Bill Cosby is forever forbidden now to use those words publicly because people don't expect it of him. I wanted to have the choice. I think you're freer when you have a choice. I think to not use them would have made me a form of restricted speaker, and I didn't want that. So I just decided to use them so they'd always be available to me.
But there weren't many comics using those words when you started.
No. Of course, you mentioned Lenny Bruce, who opened the door for that kind of language, but he didn't, so to speak, get away with it. They hunted him down and killed him, the Catholic Church and the police. So he was the one who opened the doors and paid for it. People like Richard Pryor and I and others who've come, Cheech and Chong and others who came afterward, were able to benefit from what happened to him and to be successful in spite of the language, not because of it.
Now, you mentioned using the, quote, dirty words for emphasis, for, you know, to be colloquial.
And because they are part of the language.
Yeah, because they're part of the language. Did you feel you ever used them to shock?
No, I think surprise is an element in comedy that is necessary. The whole point of comedy is to evoke a laugh by surprising someone, taking them down one path and suddenly leading them somewhere else unexpectedly. So surprise is an element necessary to comedy. Shock is a sort of more intensified surprise. Now, the reason I avoid the word shock in describing this is because it's one of those words that people conveniently use to say more than they mean. Always using it for shock value, as if there is no value beyond that in the word. Now, granted, sometimes you'll use a word or an expression to emphasize strongly. Now, if that shocks someone, then it's a shock. But you're not using it for the shock value. You're using it for its emphasis. There are times on stage when you need to get someone's attention above and beyond the level you've gotten it so far. You need to change the intensity of what you're doing. The texture has to change. Sometimes it's with your tone of voice. Other times it's with your choice of words. There are plenty of words that are dramatic and that grab people's attention that aren't dirty, filthy, or off color. But many of the ones that are forbidden are words that are very useful to accomplish that, to get to change the intensity of people's concentration. So so people get lazy and call it shock value. And there might be some people who use it only for that purpose, but I think after a while, the effect wears off. I like using them because they're very useful in language. When I grew up, I was told to respect three groups of people, among some others. Three groups in particular I remember. Policemen, always be nice and respect the policeman, he's your friend. Soldiers and sailors and the people in the armed forces, and sports heroes. And as I grew up, I found out the way these people spoke. Policemen and Marines and ball players use this language, and apparently it didn't have any moral effect on them. So
when you go on TV and you have to clean up your monologues, do you use different parts or do you just take out the forbidden words?
No, I do things that don't require those words. I have, I have the ability to find things in life that are humorous, that are gentle and somewhat innocent and which can be expressed without using forceful or street language. So I use those things because I'm not on television to change their system. I'm there usually to promote myself. I do a trade-off with television. I use them and they use me and I get what I want out of it, which is to mention some project I'm involved in. So I'm not there to change the system. I'm there to fit in for those few minutes and I try to do that by using other humor that doesn't require this kind of forceful expression.
What kind of language did you grow up with? You've called yourself a street corner comic when you were growing up.
Right.
So what kind of language did you use then?
Well, we were a tough neighborhood, so you can imagine.
Where was this?
123rd in Amsterdam in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
We called it White Harlem because that sounded tougher than Morningside Heights, which is what Columbia University wanted to call it. And we grew up there very close to that institutional neighborhood, Teachers College, Barnard, Columbia, St. John the Divine, Grant's Tomb, Riverside Church, Juilliard School of Music, Union Theological Seminary, and Jewish Theological Seminary on one side of us, and on the other side, a Puerto Rican and Cuban section and Black Harlem. So we had this little Irish enclave, and to be tough to other guys, we called ourselves guys from White Harlem.
So what did it mean to be a street corner comic? I mean, what do you mean
when you
say that?
Well, all I meant is that I was one of the funny guys. There were a lot of kids in my neighborhood that were funny. The Irish have a vocal gift, many of them, a gift of speech and storytelling and being colorful speakers. And so it was a lively scene on the street corner or on the stoops, the verbal jousting and the insults, the dozens, the black street game, the dozens. Which involves insulting each other's mothers and close relatives. All this stuff went on, and you had to be kind of quick to survive. Well, beyond that kind of repartee, which is maybe a high-toned word for something a little more common in nature, I also did routines. I could imitate people and do voices and characters, and so I would make up these stories and routines and I was kind of the comic in the crowd, and they'd pay attention to me, and I'd talk for 10 or so minutes, and then the next time I'd see them, they'd say, George, you do that thing again, about what? And I'd forget what it was. So I was a kind of a guerrilla entertainer on the street corner.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is comic George Carlin, and he has many comedy albums, has also recently been appearing in movies such as Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and Outrageous Fortune. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. George Carlin is my guest. You were one of the first comics to do observational humor about being high.
Hmm.
You eventually developed a coke habit, which you kicked a few years ago. I'm wondering how you think it changed your monologues when you gave up those drugs.
Well, because it changed most everything else about my life. By the way, I gave up my drugs one at a time. I wasn't one of these people who went somewhere and came back different. Uh-huh. I had to evolve because these things that I had used, pot, beer, tobacco, and cocaine, had taken a long time to become part of my life, and so it took a while to get over them. And I dropped them one at a time. And the way I dropped them was by noticing, one by one, noticing that they were more trouble than pleasure. And so my common sense told me, this is stupid, George. This isn't why. You're supposed to be doing these things to feel better, not to feel worse. So they went away one at a time.
Do you think that your subject matter has changed, since a lot of your subject matter used to be about drugs?
Well, if I may correct you politely, people have that impression, and it's not as true, I think, as they see it. There was some... I obviously referred to them strongly when I did a bit about them, but compared to the number of bits I did, the percentage was really not much more than you'd expect at that time, when mm-hmm. drugs were more glorified and more in the foreground. So it's true there was more of it then in my act, but the percentage wasn't so high. But the focus lately has been more toward political and social commentary on, you know, the culture and stuff, because that's what's emerged next for me. A lot of these things come and go. For several years, I'm interested in dogs and what's in the refrigerator and how we tie our shoes and how we drive and a place for your stuff. And then suddenly I find myself paying attention to other things. I don't drive this bus. I ride on it. And I look out the window, and suddenly I'm seeing things that are different from 5 years ago. So I'm happy now that I'm getting to vent some of this frustration and anger at what I really see as a declining second-rate culture. Sorry.
Hey, I don't take it personally.
No, I know. I was sort of saying it to the culture.
Oh. Did drugs ever help you on stage?
I don't think so. I think... You see, I'll never know because I can't know both things.
Right.
But I would have to say that the only thing they ever helped with was endurance. I used to do these 2.5-hour shows, and a certain, you know, the result of speed drugs, a certain kind of relentlessness. But as far as thinking was concerned, I mean, these things alter the function of the brain. They alter the electrochemical functions of the brain, and that doesn't help, especially in quantities, using them in quantities that are completely out of line.
Now, you had a club career before you... before you became...
I started in nightclubs.
Yeah, but, I mean, you started in nightclubs before you became known as a counterculture, radical type comic.
But let's go back to step A, because
yeah.
Nightclubs were step B and countercultural was step C. In step A, I was a folk room... Mm-hmm. Folk room coffee house comic who did have an edge. I did have an edge in my material. There was a degree of irreverence because those audiences and those places were places of irreverence. It was the end of the beatnik era, prior to what became the hippies. And there has always been that subculture. Bohemians was the name for it once. There'll always be that rebellious group that is swimming against the tide. And I identified with them from my childhood. So I was from that wellspring, and I became this kind of nightclub, safe nightclub comedian with a tie because I felt that was, I guess, I felt that's what I had to do to have an acting career. I wanted to be like Danny Kaye and Red Skelton. My boyhood dream was to be a comic actor in movies, and I saw comedy as a stepping stone. I didn't know that I'd be as good at it as I think I am, nor that it would last as long as it has. So I saw it as a stepping stone, and that period of, let's say, 1965 through 1970 was a period of trying to play the game as I saw the game in order to get somewhere, which is a mistake, but that's what life is for, I think, having a chance to make these mistakes and correct them. So when I became, as it were, you know, this new figure, this different guy, which, by the way, happened slowly, I didn't go away to the mountain and come back different. I grew my beard in public, and I let my hair grow, and my material changed slowly. But when that change came, it was back to something I was originally, in a more intense form, no question. And by that time, there was a very large counterculture. The bohemian beatnik sort of underground had become part of the above ground. And so there was an audience out there that was ready and willing for me to meet. And that was what was terrific about that period for me.
Well, during those safe years when you were trying to play the game and make it with a suit and tie and everything, what kind of humor were you doing?
Well, it was kind of superficial stuff. I think it was funny. There was some, as I listen to it now, the bomb thrower in me was even active then, because there are these little swipes at straight society that were taking place. Even Al Sleet, the hippy-dippy weatherman, who was this, who was a part of that mainstream period I was in, Al Sleet was clearly a pothead and a guy who was, not one of them. So it's funny how I was even infiltrating my own comedy with these people and these ideas. But I was doing mostly media-oriented parody. I did stuff about newscasts, disc jockeys, weathermen, commercials, soap operas, all things based on television and radio, and mostly parody, and for the most part, kind of superficial stuff.
Well, you had gotten your start on radio.
Yeah, I was a DJ. That was part of my boyhood plan. I'll become a disc jockey, and if I'm good enough at that, they'll have to let me be a comedian. And if I'm good enough at that, they'll have to let me become an actor. That was kind of my 10-year-old, when I was 10 or 11, my plan. And it worked pretty much the way I had hoped. The comedy period lasted much longer, and I'm entering the acting phase later than I expected, but that's beginning to have some real substance to it.
When you were on the radio, were you always a comic and a DJ on radio, or did you ever have like a really straight job where you had to seriously have that announcer's voice?
Well, I, for the most part, worked on Top 40 radio before it was rigidly formulated, and there was at least a little room for personality then. And so I clowned a little. I used some voices, and I would, when I did a live commercial, I would play with it and make fun of it. And I was somewhat entertaining besides just giving the time, temperature, and weather. And then there were other situations in radio where I was less able to do that, where the log was more crowded with commercials and there wasn't enough time to be a personality. So I experienced both things. It was only a 4-year period.
You went to Catholic school.
Yeah, I went to a rather progressive Catholic parochial school, which was very much different from the kind of horror stories we hear about Catholic schools, especially in that era. I went to a school where the nuns were specially trained. They had special master's degrees from Catholic University. We were taught religion, but we didn't have uniforms. We didn't have the sexes in different classrooms. There was no corporal punishment. It was very progressive. Certainly for the 1940s, it was progressive, because what it amounted to is that the Catholic Church was actually experimenting with humane treatment. And by the way, my third grade teacher, Sister Marie Richard, I've been in touch with her over recent years. She's now called Melita Conlon, and she wears street clothes, but she's still part of the Dominican Teaching Order. And she encourages me. She says, I know that what you do is sort of in service of a larger objective. And she has given me, if I needed it, which maybe I did, a kind of imprimatur from my former Catholic teachers that what I'm doing is okay.
Comic George Carlin. He's featured in the forthcoming films Prince of Tides and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure Part 2. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actress and writer Carrie Fisher. Her film adaptation of her book Postcards from the Edge opens this week, and she has a new novel, Surrender the Pink. I hope you can join us.
Then there are words we need, words that don't exist. Chalant. We have nonchalant. So the concept of chalance exists. What about chalant? Near-fetched. Something very obvious. Say, that's near-fetched, Bill.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor John Mahoney was featured in the recent films Eight Men Out, Betrayed, Moonstruck, and Say Anything. If you don't remember him from earlier movies, that's because he started late, at the age of 37. Coming up, John Mahoney on giving up a boring career to take up acting and going on to work with such directors as Roman Polanski, John Sayles, and Costa Gavras. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new sitcoms Lenny, Babes, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and Uncle Buck. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraq's president had a surprise statement today broadcast on Iraqi radio and television. And as Terry Phillips reports from Baghdad, the statement is one that could have an effect on the international embargo.
Saddam Hussein is offering free oil to all third world nations. The surprise announcement was read by the Iraqi president's TV spokesman today. Saddam says it is an expression of solidarity with those poor countries who have not yet benefited from the oil riches of the Middle East. Saddam also addressed the issue of the United Nations-sanctioned economic embargo. He says this offer will not violate the international boycott since it does not involve any buying or selling. All the receiving nations have to do is to come up with a means of delivery. Iraq will provide the oil at no cost. For National Public Radio, I'm Terry Phillips in Baghdad.
U.S. Secretary of State James Baker wants NATO allies to send ground troops to the Persian Gulf to help out in the military deployment there. Baker says that Britain and France have already sent ground forces to the Gulf, and Turkey also has large numbers of troops in the area. The secretary has also announced that he will have Gulf crisis talks in Syria later on this week, a country on the U.S. list of nations supporting terrorism. The European Economic Community has invited all Arab League countries except for Iraq to a meeting in Venice next month. That meeting is expected to center on the Gulf crisis. There are 21 countries in the Arab League. Rival Cambodian factions signed an agreement in Jakarta today aimed at ending the country's bloody civil war. As NPR's Deborah Wong reports, it's being hailed as a first step toward peace in Cambodia.
Representatives of the Cambodian government and the three guerrilla groups signed the agreement today after days of intense negotiations. The parties agreed in principle to disarm and to allow the United Nations to monitor a ceasefire and organize free elections. They also agreed to form a council composed of leaders of the rival factions that would represent Cambodia at the United Nations. The agreement was the most far-reaching ever signed by the four parties. They've been fighting a civil war since the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia in 1979. The agreement was drafted by members of the United Nations Security Council, which includes the United States, the Soviet Union, and China, all backers of different factions in the civil war. Although the plan is being hailed as a major breakthrough, the leaders say it's only a framework. They must meet again in Paris to hammer out details of a ceasefire, a process which could take weeks or even months. I'm Deborah Wong in Jakarta.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 4 points to close at 2,615.59 on volume of some 120 million shares. Trading was light as advancing issues led declines by only a slight margin. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. John Mahoney had just started acting in Chicago when he met John Malkovich. Malkovich was a founding member of the Steppenwolf Theater, and he invited Mahoney to join the company. That was in the late 70s, and Mahoney has been acting ever since. He won a Tony Award for his role in John Gare's House of Blue Leaves. In the last few years, Mahoney has branched out into movies. In Moonstruck, he played the college professor who makes a play for Olympia Dukakis. In Eight Men Out, he was Kid Gleason, the manager of the White Sox. And in Say Anything, he played the father. When I spoke with John Mahoney last May, he was in a Goodman Theater production of Uncle Vanya, adapted by David Mamet. Acting wasn't Mahoney's first career. For years, he edited a medical journal, so I wanted to know what was covered in the journal.
Ophthalmology or cataract surgery or central supply, or it could be anything, virtually any aspect of the healthcare system as it is within a hospital. And it's very, very boring, actually. I've tried to think of some way to make it more interesting, but it isn't, and it wasn't, which is a lot to do with why I don't do it anymore.
When did you know that you were really unhappy in this job?
Well, it wasn't anything that where you go home every night and bang your head against a wall and say, oh, my God, I'm so unhappy. It was it was just an insidious thing. You just keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and gradually you realize that you're smoking an awful lot and that you're drinking a little bit too much and that you're sleeping very late whenever you can. And it wasn't until I started to do my new job, which was acting, that I looked back and realized the absolute depth of my depression while I was doing the editorial work.
It takes a lot of guts or a lot of despair to make a big change
exactly.
like that when you don't know what the outcome's going to be. Was there a pivot mm-hmm. point, a moment where you said, okay, that's it, I'm quitting?
Well, it's not so much that made me say, I'm quitting. There was a point that made me say, my God, I've got to do that as opposed to what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I was in London, and I went to the National Theatre and saw a production of Jumpers by Tom Stoppard. And I remember that production starring Michael Hordern as if it were yesterday. It just sort of just ignited me, and I just was left limp at the end of it. And I thought, my God, I've got to do that. I've got to do that no matter what. I've got to do that. And if I can't do it, I've at least got to try to do it. And I just can't be 60, 65, 70 years old looking back on a life and saying, oh, my God, why didn't I do that? I came back to Chicago, and I went to see A View from the Bridge, and it was the same thing. And I don't know whether the production was that great or whether I was just so, by this time, burning with this intense desire that it was the same thing. And then I saw that they were offering classes at the St. Nicholas Theater, and I thought, okay, well, this is it. This is my chance. So I enrolled in an acting class and at the St. Nicholas Theater, and at the same time quit my job because there was no time to rehearse with other actors or do anything if I were working. And looking back on it, it was madness. I mean, to give up a good, well-paying, prestigious job and embark on probably the most precarious career in existence, a career where at any given time 95% of the union is out of work, was just insanity.
When you started to act, and you were already, what, in your late 30s?
Yeah, 37.
Was it embarrassing or awkward being a mature man and being a novice as an actor?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who the other people were, who you were acting with and who were taking classes with you. You might have been older than they were,
you know,
less
funny,
experienced than they were. It could make you very self-conscious.
It would in a situation where you weren't so happy. I mean, I was never self-conscious in that situation. I'll tell you when I was more self-conscious in a similar situation is when I went to started college.
When you were younger?
When I was younger, but I had been in the Army, and I'd emigrated. I'd gotten out of high school in England. I'd emigrated to the United States. I'd worked for a while. I'd been in the Army for 3 years, and so I was quite a bit older than the rest of my class. And I was constantly mistaken for a teacher as opposed to a fellow student. And I always felt a lot different. I don't know whether it was because of the maturity that came with being an ex-serviceman or whatever it was, but there was always a little uncomfortable quality there. But with acting, even though I went into, even though I was in class with people who, on average, were probably 15 years younger than I was, I never felt any self-consciousness at all because I was too consumed with the excitement and the thrill of doing this.
All the years that you weren't acting and you were mm-hmm. editing this medical newsletter, did mm-hmm. you use any acting skills in your life?
No, I didn't. I think I was storing up a lot of things that I have used since.
You weren't sitting at your desk impersonating people or you know, just using in everyday life skills associated with acting.
No, I really wasn't, unless lying is part of that. You know? I mean, obviously, I'd have to lie to writers who couldn't write their way out of a paper bag and tell them how wonderful they were as I tried to make their stuff publishable. So maybe if if good acting is good lying, then maybe I was doing that.
You grew up in England. What happened to your English accent?
Well, I tried very hard to lose it. I immigrated to the States when I was 19, and I'm from the north of England. And I just, I'm not the sort of person who likes to stand out in a crowd, which might sound strange for an actor. I mean, I like to shine on the stage or in a film, but on one-on-one, I just like to be like everybody else. And even in those days, it used to drive me crazy when people would say, oh, I love the way you talk. Oh, isn't that wonderful? Or say this, or say that, or say banana, or say, you know. And they were being nice, but it would drive me crazy. And so I set out to learn how to speak like an American. And I would ask people, I was in the Army at the time, and I'd ask people, how do you pronounce this? How do you say half? And they'd say half. And I'd say, how do you say banana? Have banana. And I'd write them down, and I'd drill myself just like I was learning a foreign language. The only trouble was I was in the Army with people from all over the United States. So somebody from Nebraska would tell me how to say one thing, and somebody from Brooklyn would tell me how to say something else. So I had this horrible mongrel accent when I got out. But when I went to school in Quincy, Illinois, I went to Quincy College, and by the time I got out of Quincy, of course, it had pretty much settled into this Midwestern thing that I have now. But I tried very hard to lose it, and it was to fit in. As boring as that sounds, it was to be like everybody else. That's why I did it.
Actor John Mahoney is my guest. He's appeared in such films as Eight Men Out, Moonstruck, and Say Anything. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor John Mahoney is my guest. When you started acting in movies or on Broadway, did you feel that there was anything you had to fake because you weren't very experienced yet?
That's very interesting. I, not so much fake, but I was intimidated, I must admit. Being older than people didn't intimidate me, but being less experienced did. And I don't know whether that's why I rely so much on a director. I hate being left to my own devices when it comes to developing a character. And I relish a good, strong director. I love that. I was more intimidated by my lack of experience than anything else. In fact, I act a little differently than most of my fellow Steppenwolfians. I remember John Malkovich telling me, you know, you're the only person I know who speaks in sentences. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, when you say lines, you can see where the period comes. You can see where the capital letter starts. You can see where the paragraph ends. And I noticed when I watched other people in Steppenwolf work that it's true. They try very consciously to break things up to make it more conversational. But you see, conversational to me is sentences. I think I express myself well, and I don't know whether it's my education or my background or because my family did. I never did speak that broken way. So
it must be hard for you to
do
Mammoth, then, huh?
Should I try? Well, no, actually, David at least writes in sentences.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think of what would be more difficult. When we did In a Nightingale Sang, it was a little difficult because, or to do something like Virginia Woolf would be a little difficult because it's written with so many ellipses. But Mammoth, no. Even though there are a lot of short one-word sentences even, it's at least you know what he wants. Even like in this particular adaptation of Uncle Vanya, at one point I say, eat, sleep, drink. I'm talking about the way my life is now as opposed to working. All I seem to do now is eat, sleep, drink. They're all one-word sentences, according to David, I guess to stop you from doing that horrible thing that so many people do now. All I do is eat and sleep and drink, you know, that horrible way that people have learned how to talk from television. And I guess as a way to get around that, David very specifically made them sentences. And so it stops you from doing that, and it's great. I love it because I wouldn't do it anyway, and it's nice to know that I'm doing what David wants as well.
You said that you like to work with strong directors.
Mm-hmm.
In movies, some of the directors you've worked with are John Sayles, Costa Gavras, Norman Jewison, Cameron Crowe.
Right.
Give me a sense of something you've learned from working with a strong director.
I liked the directors you mentioned are all so different.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Jewison and Roman Polanski, for example, would be behind the camera, jumping up and down, laughing, crying, cheering you on silently to such a degree that it's almost distracting to you. John Sayles and Barry Levinson, on the other hand, will be behind the camera and you have no idea whether they like what you're doing. You get to the end of a take for Norman or Roman and they say, "Wonderful, great, 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 that was wonderful." You get to the end of a take with John or Barry and it's, "Okay, let's move on," or, "Okay, new setup." And you say, "Well, how was it?" "Oh, it was good." "Well, just good?" You know, "Well, no, it was very good. It was very good. That's why we're moving on." They're just not, they're just not very demonstrative. And I like a little more structure. I like to be able to discuss something. I like to go up to, like, with Norman Jewison and Moonstruck and be able to say, "Norman, do you think this whole thing is a line that he's used before?" And Norman say, "Well, okay, well, let's sit down and talk about this." And then start to give me reasons, pro and con, and what his feelings are and how they should be played, as opposed to a director who will say, "Well, let's see, what do you think?" Or, you know, which drives me nuts. "Well, just do what you feel," you know, or something like that. It's such a, it's just sloughing off responsibility, because I think a director should be there for you and should be there to help you through things. And that's what I mean by a strong director. I don't mean somebody, Eric von Stroheim, or somebody who holds a whip and snaps it or something like that, or makes you jump through hoops. But I mean somebody who has very definite opinions, who's thought about this and who will give them to you and will help you, as opposed to somebody who might think that the sun rises and shines in you and therefore you do whatever you want. I don't like that.
You know how you worked on your voice to get rid of your English accent?
Uh-huh.
When you started acting, did you do any work with your voice on enunciation? You have a beautiful voice and great enunciation.
Oh,
thank
you.
Yeah. I mean, not over-enunciation, but
yeah.
It's just really great. Did you work that up? Was it natural already?
That was pretty natural, yes. I'll tell you, I worked on the timbre of my voice when I was doing Orphans before we moved to New York.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to be playing an alcoholic, and I wanted a rough quality in my voice that I didn't have. And so I worked very, very hard to get a gravelly quality to it. And my voice never quite recovered from that. And so it sounds a little different now than it did when I first started out. But it's to my advantage, actually, because I guess I have a much more distinctive voice now than I used to have. And people notice it and remember me by it, which I like very much. As far as enunciation, no, that just comes, I think, from possibly being born and raised in England, perhaps, or I just do tend to enunciate. In fact, to such a degree that I've had other actors tell me that I do it too much. I remember I was doing Born Yesterday at Steppenwolf, and Glenn Headley used to tell me, she played Billy, and I played Harry Brock, and she'd sometimes tell me, "You're hitting those final consonants much too hard. You know, people don't talk like that." And I said, "Well, Glenn, people do talk like that because I talk like that."
When you were working up the gravelly voice, what did you do?
I used to lock myself in closets, and I used to do very, very strenuous vocal warm-up exercises. And people didn't want to be in the same room as me. I made these horrible sounds. I mean, I started slowly, and I warmed my voice up before I started doing that. And as far as I know, knock on wood, I haven't hurt it or damaged it. But people do say, especially at the end of an evening when my voice is pretty much shot, or not at the end of an evening, but at the end of a two-show day, people get worried about it and say, "Are you all right? Is your voice okay? And I say, "Oh, yeah, it's fine, no problem. It'll be back tomorrow just the same as, and it always is. It's always there just as strong as can be. But people it did, the things that I did sound terrible. I know it shocked a lot of actors with the ferocity of my vocal warm-ups. Shocked a lot of people in New York.
My gosh, what were you doing?
Well, I can't do it on the radio because, for one thing, it's much too loud. And for another thing, it's just much too ugly. You know, if I back way away from the microphone, I might be able to give you a little demonstration here. It's just something like...
Wow.
No, I don't know what you heard there, because I backed away quite a bit.
That's really something, so you'd lock yourself up in a closet and do that for a long time.
Well, it's not, I mean, and I wouldn't do it just right off the bat, just like I did then. Uh-huh. I'd do very gentle things first, you know, just sort of, things like that until, for a good half hour, I spend a lot of time warming my voice up so that I don't damage it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm very happy with the way it turned out, actually. I think it's gotten me a lot of work, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, well, you really have a wonderful voice.
Well, thanks.
You took a really big risk when you left writing and editing to work in acting. Once that risk paid off, not only in terms of success but in terms of just fulfillment, did you find yourself taking other big risks in life that you wouldn't have dreamed of taking before?
I guess I did. I bought a house. That's a big risk. Let me think. What other risks are there, to tell you the truth? I really don't know what other risks I have, you know, that have been open to me. I don't think I'm afraid to do anything or go anywhere. I have a tremendous amount of confidence now in myself as a person, in myself as an actor, in myself as a successful person. And I think it has carried over into all aspects of my life. I'm not intimidated by anybody or any situation. If I look out at an audience when I was doing House of Blue Leaves and see George C. Scott out there, or Jack Nicholson, or Paul Newman, or Henry Miller, Arthur Miller, I'm not intimidated by anybody whatsoever or any situation whatsoever. And I guess this has a lot to do with it. I guess the success that I made in the biggest challenge of my life had a lot to do with that.
Well, listen, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
John Mahoney. He co-stars with Sean Connery and Michelle Pfeiffer in the upcoming film Russia House. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on Saddam Hussein's latest offer?
Apparently, Iraq is giving away oil. All you have to do is come get it. There's no charge, void where prohibited, and United States need not apply. We're also starting a series called The Prejudice Puzzle. Verda Mae Grosvenor is the reporter on the first part, and it's called Interracial. It's about interracial children. Samuel Doe, the president of Liberia, is believed to be dead, and we will be covering that story and trying to figure out what is going to happen next. And Evelyn Murphy, the lieutenant governor of Massachusetts, has dropped out of the race for governor after creating a controversy last week.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are more new TV series this fall than ever before, so it's more of a challenge for each series premiere to stand out and attract an audience. TV critic David Bianculli sizes up a few new sitcoms that start this week.
Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down, and I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel-Air.
The best of this week's new sitcoms is NBC's Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. It takes a popular, non-threatening rap singer whose video, Parents Just Don't Understand, was a big novelty hit 2 years ago, and plunks him into a sitcom format that's almost painfully familiar. A poor kid from the East gets transplanted to the rich life in California. But before you dismiss this as another piece of TV dreck like Different Strokes, look again. Fresh Prince, whose real name is Will Smith, really is a fresh talent. And his on-camera attitude makes him the biggest contender for breakout stardom since the early days of Robin Williams and Eddie Murphy. Here's Smith meeting the black butler of the uncle and aunt he's come west to live with.
Hey, Uncle Phil! Oh! How you doing? I am not your Uncle Philip.
Oh, my fault, man. I must have got the wrong crib. But, hey, yo, I ain't know there were so many brothers living in this neighborhood. We doing all right, huh?
You have the right house. I am Jeffrey, your uncle's butler.
Oh, okay, well, cheerio and all that rot, and I
bring the horses around, would you?
Another sitcom built around a strong talent is CBS's Lenny, which stars stand-up comedian Lenny Clark as a blue-collar worker with a loving spouse and three kids, sort of a male Roseanne. Problem is, Clark is funnier than the show he's in, and you can tell that large chunks of dialogue are nothing more than stand-up routines delivered sitting down, like when he watches a boxing match on TV.
Blue Trunks and Dover is in the green.
That kills me. Ballard's in the blue trunks, Dover's in the green. Why don't they just say Ballard's the black guy, Dover's the white guy? I mean, look at these two mooks. The white guy's incredibly white. Looks like he's traveled everywhere by tunnel for the last 6 months. And the black guy's blacker than midnight at the bottom of a well. And he's got the word victory shaved in the side of his head, and they can only tell him apart by their trunks.
At least some of Clark's lines are funny. That's more than you can say about Babes, a new Fox series that's supposed to take a loving look at three overweight sisters, but that spends much of its time laughing at them, not with them. Listen to the cruel remarks made by a secretary when the three sisters enter her office to inquire about a job.
What is this, Fantasia?
Thank you very much.
My sister here has an appointment with Mr. Ivenstein.
Here, take a seat. Hell, take as many as you need.
Finally, there's a TV spinoff of the movie Uncle Buck. This new CBS sitcom, also called Uncle Buck, is so offensive, I won't even play a clip from it. With Uncle Buck, CBS is trying to be naughty like Married with Children on Fox, but ends up just being rude. With Babes, Fox is claiming to be sensitive, but is really being mean. With Lenny, CBS is trying to be like Roseanne and not really succeeding. And with Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, NBC is trying to be like the Beverly Hillbillies with a hip-hop sensibility. And believe it or not, it works. Fresh Prince isn't great, but in a fall season when no new show is great, good is as good as it gets.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
She's the daughter of Debbie Reynolds and Eddie Fisher. She was Princess Leia. But what Carrie Fisher is becoming well-known for now is her witty writing. On the next Fresh Air, Carrie Fisher on her new book, Surrender the Pink, and her screenplay, Postcards from the Edge. Also, Daniel Levy on reviving the literature of the 60s. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.